Hey folks, it's Blammo. I'm your host, your favorite bald dude. I hope I'm your favorite bald dude. It's Jeremy Kirkland. How we all doing? We good? Okay, moving on. We're gonna get right into it. Just right into it. This episode, it's gonna have you questioning a lot of things. I mean, geez, I was re-listening to it before I recorded this intro, and I was like, what the hell is going on? I would say this is probably one of the most interesting conversations I've had on clothing to date. There's just some weird stuff in there. It's good. It's fun. It's weird. I like things that get me a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, I'm uncomfortable right now just making this intro. I don't even know what I'm doing. I'll tell you the truth. My kids are freaking out. My internet's been wonky. You know, everything is upsetting me. I got issues with cars. I got issues with money. I got issues with my roof. I got issues with myself. How about that? There we go. We all feeling weird. So now you're ready for the episode. But look, I having the conversation, to get real for a second, I was very confused. I was infatuated. I was excited all at the same time. So how's all of that for this kind of like joy or whatever feeling you want to, you know, amalgamate these two? But yeah, so we talk about clothing a lot on the show. I mean, Blammo is a show about people wearing clothes, right? But, you know, sometimes we're trying to figure out ourselves through clothing. You know, we're on that existential journey, or we're solving some sort of problem with the world, or we're just flexing because we think we're cool. And maybe it's all of the above at the same time. But what about your focus is designing clothing to last 100 years, or even for climates outside of Earth, or things to go survive the apocalypse, or whatever that there is? All right, are you ready? Are you still there? Yeah, enter Volibec. So here we go. My guest this week is Steve Tidbull of Volibec, a brand co-founded with his twin brother, and they are making clothes for the future right now. Steve and I discuss what do we need for the next 100 years, the changes that need to happen, if Wally was right, I think they were, enhanced organisms trying to live forever, and how clothing is a part of all of it. Are you ready? Buckle up, folks. Here we go. When you see all the video stuff that people are into right now, and everyone's kind of making these...
Real.
Yeah.
It's like, it couldn't be real. Yeah.
I don't know if it's good or bad. Like, it's good in the sense that we're all sharing these things, but I don't know if it's bad that we all need these things right now, because, like, it means we're not getting it somewhere else, maybe? I don't know.
Well, I prefer it, because obviously I grew up in Avatar. I know I look about 14, but I'm actually halfway through my 40s. But I grew up in advertising, and it's all bullshit, basically. And you just half the time, you're just like, why don't you just tell people the fucking truth? And then you can't tell people the truth, because actually our drink is made out of entirely sugar, or the car fails right after 1,000 miles. But yeah, if you can tell the truth, it's just so much funnier. So I always wanted to do, we'll get into this, but I always wanted to do a brand where you just tell the truth. I'm half Serbian, and there's a Serbian proverb called tell the truth, then run.
Really?
I'm like, fuck, that's good. Well, the truth is always just much more fascinating.
Okay.
It's just always way more what people are into, because a lot of people don't want to reveal themselves, do they? Like, it's very uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable for a lot of people to tell the truth.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it just has to do with, like, if I show you, you know, my flaws, will you respect me? You know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, not to even just jump in as deep as this, but, like, I think that's a thing where why some like influencers like pop off from things where it sounds like they're revealing their, you know, I'm air quoting the word truth, but really it's just like bullshit, like overtly positive. Like here's you want my truth. I'll be honest. This morning, I woke up this morning and I was like, cool. I was looking at my schedule. The kids, my daughter is in kindergarten. She's on spring break, and my son is almost 2. And so he's still in like preschool. And, you know, so she's home. And so my wife and I are kind of like tag teaming, like different stuff to do. I'm going to take her to the museum tomorrow, whatever. And I'm like, well, the good thing is at least my youngest, you know, we're going to take him to preschool, and I'm getting him dressed. And he's like kind of fussy. And, you know, we're getting ready to walk out the door, and he just vomits everywhere. And I was like, fuck. I was like, man, this fucking, and I was so mad.
And obviously, like, I'm not going to, like, do anything to my son, you know, but I was just so pissed that everything was going on. And then my wife's like, oh, gosh, hold on. And I, like, put him in this laundry basket and he just keeps vomiting everywhere. And he's, like, throwing up on me and he's throwing, you know.
So you put him in the laundry basket, not his clothes.
Yeah, I just put him in there so we could finish throwing up. We get a bath going, all this stuff. And, you know, one of the reasons why we moved back to the Midwest where from New York was just like there's family support. Like the family was, you know, this is before we even had our second. And it's just like everything is fucking chaos all the time. And I feel tough that like, do I have to make this like smokescreen, you know, where people think that I'm like off doing all these cool things, but really like right before we're recording, I just like nearly yelled at my kids being like, dad's got to go record. Don't come in here, you know? And they're just
I think that'd be much funnier. I think because so few people actually tell the truth about how stuff works, it's just so cut through. Because I think, yeah, I agree with you. A lot of it is now kind of like Instagram real, isn't it? Which is like not actually real. It's kind of, it's controlled, it's contained, it's planned.
Yeah.
Which is very, very different from actual reality. Because you can't, you know, you probably can't script your kid throwing up all over your clothes.
No.
Well, not twice anyway.
Yeah.
So that's not going to work. So yeah, I'd watch that. I'd watch you like fucking up. That sounds really good.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
That's basically the gist of it. It's the same
with a company though. Like I think Elon compared, you know, running a startup to looking into the abyss while chewing glass.
Oh, that's wow, like, that's a rare Elon thing I'm into. Yeah.
It's probably early and dark. But that's not the presentation, is it? That's not the PR statements. That's not any of the stuff you actually see. You won't see that on anyone's website.
Yeah.
You'll just see the good bits. You'll just see like the carefully catalogued, controlled, edited stuff.
Yeah.
Not the actual kind of, oh God, what are we going to do? Stuff.
I think on like the clothing side, I think definitely people are more into, because I'm sure, so you come from an advertising background and a lot of the stuff that we're seeing now, like collectively, just across brands from clothing to, you know, spirits to cars to whatever, are these weird forms of transparency where like, I think Noah does like a pretty good job on their website where they're like, hey, here's what it costs to actually make this stuff, you know, or here's, and I'm curious like what your take is on some of these things, because especially with your brand, which we'll get into, the, you know, you communicate a little bit more about the production, why this is a special fabric versus like, we make a cool jacket. It's cool. That's enough. You know, like here's a picture of, cool Hugh Grant wearing.
Hugh Grant, eh?
There's my dated reference. I still think Hugh Grant's cool.
Is that pre his Hollywood moment?
I don't know. I think it was because I was watching like some old, like cool 80s, 90s movies lately and like Hugh Grant and like Notting Hill and stuff. I'm just like, fuck, he's cool.
I watched that again recently. Yeah, that's good. Because it's obviously, there's two sides, isn't there? That, and then there's him as the tiny orange guy in Wonka, which is like a whole different world.
Yeah, haven't seen that yet. Heard Hugh Grant's a bit spicy at times. So
yeah, he is. I like him as that. I think it's fun, but it must be really weird because he was obviously like a super good looking guy, and then you, like everybody, you become old.
Yeah,
and so what do you then do? This is like you can't play the good looking guy anymore, right? There comes a time when that's not your role anymore.
Yeah, it's true.
You have to reinvent yourself. Yeah. So your question was around like transparency. With our stuff, I just want to tell the truth about what we're making. I mean, lots of the stuff that we make, we make really, really difficult to make with materials. Like we make it really hard. Like if you wanted to go and start a clothing brand, I mean, we're a terrible clothing brand, but let's say you said you wanted to make black t-shirts and red t-shirts out of polyester and you want to manufacture in China. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the easiest brand in the world to start. You're going to have no production issues. Everything's going to go swimmingly. But obviously, you've got a giant marketing problem, which is, well, you know, why? Why should anyone give a shit? Why should anyone buy this? What's the deal? And we kind of set out completely the opposite way, which was essentially what are the materials that basically no one's thought to make clothes out of? Because clothing, like shoes, is basically cows, right? It's leather. So it's a cow.
Yeah, I've never heard it reduced to that, but yes, I'm inclined to agree.
And clothes is plastics, which is predominantly polyester. And there's some cottons, obviously. So you do 99.9% of the world wandering around in cotton and polyester, and they've all got cows on their feet. All right. So if you want to go and make out of those three things, good on you. You know, you've got the supply chains. They're already set up. You can do whatever you want. And then we come along and go, right, you see that parachute that just landed the rover on Mars? What if we can use that material? Or like, you see those kind of like Arctic ropes that are holding those massive ships down? What's that made out of? Wonder if you can make a jacket out of that.
So we cheap.
Oh, it's really cheap. Yeah, but that's exactly, yeah. And so what you find is, well, first of all, yeah, it's not cheap. It's really, really, really fucking expensive. Second of all, no one necessarily wants to work with you because who on earth are you? And that's not who we supply. You know, we supply parachutes to NASA. We supply, you know, ropes to Arctic shipping companies. And so you go through this big song and dance of like, well, we're trying to introduce new materials. And if you could just give us a shot. And so, and then obviously what's happened is you can get these kind of like crazy fabrics. You might want to develop them a bit, you know, change them a bit to make them really cool for clothing. And then you've got, you know, a fabric mill that goes, oh, this is going to be tricky. It's going to be really expensive. Yeah. And even then, once you've done the material, then you've got a factory going, oh, we've never done this before. It's going to be really tricky and really expensive. So like, if you'd written this down as a business case, I mean, it looks completely bananas. It's basically, we're going to do everything the hardest way possible. It's like, I don't know, it's like you could run the 100 meters or you could sort of climb a pole in the middle of it and crawl through a ditch and set yourself on fire. And it's like, well, that's the route we chose. But I mean, there's a reason I do it. It's not just because I'm like a masochist.
Right.
It's because I fundamentally believe that clothes are going to change, right? I just, if I do, you look at the future, right? And I think about things in terms of inevitable futures. So you come back in 100 years time. Are we all wearing cotton and polyester? No, of course we're not. Our clothes are going to be, you know, delivering medicine, modulate, you know, neuromodulation. They're going to be bionic implants. They're going to be all sorts of crazy things.
Do you really
things.
Think that?
Oh, fuck yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just utterly, utterly inevitable.
Is how long from now, just out of curiosity?
Well, so I work off, so I don't know, but I'll come back to that. So okay. I work off, I start with periods of certainty. So if you cut forward 1,000 years, am I right? Yes. I mean, I think you will literally have people implanting bionic wings into themselves. I think we have different subspecies. I think there's all sorts of crazy, crazy stuff going on.
Okay.
Then you're really working back and going, well, what's the time scale? So is it in a year's time? No, absolutely not. Is it in 1,000 years time? Yes. And you're sort of like cutting back. And so a reasonable estimate, I would say, would within about 50 years, I think you're definitely going to have modified human entities. And I think clothing will be a part of that.
Oh.
I think thinking about ourselves as the finished article is really dumb. And we can already see from all the like chips that people are making to implant inside your brain. I mean, whether we all think this is a good idea, I don't. it's going to happen. And so really you think about kind of, well, what's that journey? And I think there's basically a segue in between all of this sort of technological infrastructure being embedded inside us, which I think it will be. I think it's going to all come much closer to the body. I don't think you're necessarily going to be holding it in your hand or wearing it on your finger. I think it's going to be close to your skin. And so I think there's a sort of halfway house before you become embedded.
Right.
Like a sort of technological cyberhuman. I think that's clothing's role. So the reason to look at all these kind of like super crazy materials and kind of some of the silly ideas we do, which I can get into later, is because I think there has to be a series of stepping stones. I don't think we move from, you know, the species I described that wears, you know, plastic on our bodies and cows on our feet. I don't think you just move from that to, hey, I'm a superhuman.
Yeah.
And I can run the 100 meters in 1 second and I can fly if I fancy it. There has to be a series of steps, right? And I think clothing is going to take part in that series of steps. And that's what I'm quite interested in doing. And so in order to do that, I have to go and set myself some absurdly tough challenges, like, you know, fireproof hoodies and disease resistant jackets and meteor proof clothes in order to start on that journey, because it doesn't start itself. So someone has to be the idiot that fires the starting pistol. And I think that's probably us.
I mean, I think that's, first off, it's a very noble idea in a good way, because when you think of, you know, because it makes me wonder, because we're in this weird part of our culture globally and how we look at clothing, right? And which clothing over time from the Industrial Revolution, you know, has just gotten cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And with that mindset, there's less of a, you know, relationship with people and their clothes, right? Like, and I think like that's the thing where like I'm always trying to like bang the drum, for lack of a better term, of the importance of the emotional aspect of what happens in your clothes. Even though for most people, because a lot of these things I'll say like are somewhat good in the sense that when clothing became cheaper, like anything else, it became more accessible and thus, you know, became less of a barrier in how we all view each other. You know, you can still dress rich, I'm going to air quote that word, but you know, you don't need clothing to more or less fit in. We can all kind of wear the same clothes, and socioeconomically, we can all more or less, you know, communicate what we want about ourselves outside of larger luxury, you know, marketing.
Yeah.
So with that, that has really distilled the relationship of how we approach clothes, because it's very democratized. Now, saying that, I'm also, there's so many asterisks in this conversation, but like, I'm very aware of the, you know, horrendous issues and what goes into making these clothes. And I think, weirdly, the same way, you know, certain cultures have turned a blind eye to things, there's, that definitely is inherent in how we all view clothes, in the sense that, like, there's just a ton of it. There's, you know, what are the things that go into actually manufacturing it? What are the pollutants that are in there? Because people are like, well, it should be bigger stuff. You know, it should be, you know, we should be focusing more on, I don't know, fuel emissions, you know, things like that, right? Yeah. But so with that in mind, when you start to make clothes that in many ways looks like it's going way back in time into buying, you know, a very, very heavily magnified buying less, but buying better, because these clothes can do A, B, C, and D, when previously your clothes just, you know, were just a way to express yourselves. How much of that is, have you all thought about in terms of just the uphill battle of communicating the relationship of what the user has with the garments?
I've thought about it a huge amount. I'm not sound boring.
Well, yeah, I'm
like,
sure.
This is the kind of stuff I think about. So like, first of all, yeah, totally accept the idea, thesis that clothes are essentially mostly social signifiers.
Yeah.
For about the last 5,000 years, it's kind of, you know, whatever, I'm a king, you know, I'm poor, you know, I love, you know, herding sheep, whatever it is. It kind of absolutely, you know, sets, defines and keeps those sort of like social hierarchies. I've thought really long and hard about what clothes should do, because essentially that is an incredibly basic role that, you know, broadly, my piece of clothing is going to keep me roughly the right temperature, and it's going to allow me to fit into consensus reality, where I, you know, wear a suit for a smart thing. I wear running shorts to go running. Gym, so I wear something tight. And so it's all very silly. So I always like to look at things from the perspective of someone from like 1,000 years before or 1,000 years after, and they sort of look back at us as sort of future people or history people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how would you define us? And I think it will be defined as an era of massive overconsumption and waste. And so one of the things I always look back at is really funnily, right, and I don't think a lot of people think about this, is sustainability was cracked forever in clothing. So now, if you say, there's a lot of debates about, you know, how old humans are, and when did we first start wearing clothes? But if we even take a sort of super generic agreed upon marker that we've had clothes for 50,000 years, right? You know, whether you agree that we emerged out of Africa or not, basically there were people a long time ago living in the ice age, right? And it was super fucking cold, and you had 2 mile high, you know, ice cliffs in fucking New York and Europe. Those fuckers had clothes. They definitely had clothes.
Yes.
And those clothes were made out of a series of different things. And there's a reason there's no evidence for these things, is because they're made out of stuff that you know, you bury in the ground, it's gone.
Yeah.
So it's made out of bark and deer skin and bits of grasses and reeds, and stuff that is basically taken off nature. So super, super sustainable. You know, I kill a sheep, I wear the sheep, I tie it together with some thread that's come from a tree, and all of that is going to biodegrade. So we humans had absolutely cracked sustainable clothing. We had it fucking nailed.
Yeah.
From 50,000 years ago, and we still had it nailed 500 years ago. Absolutely nailed.
Yeah.
Because at that point, you're not working with furs anymore, you're working with fibers, you've got cottons, silks, and hemps. And so at the very least, we had sustainable clothing absolutely nailed for 49,500 years. So we're really fucking good at this shit.
Yeah.
And then along comes Mr. and Mrs. Factory. And they just like, hey, you know what we need? You know this cotton stuff we're growing? We can make millions of meters, and we can fuck the earth, and we can do all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the amount of water we're using. So even if you go post, I wouldn't really be too accusatory of like early industrialization, but certainly into the 20th century, you can go like, we're royally fucking stuff now. So certainly post, let's say post-World War II even, where you go, okay, mass manufacturing, cheap, distributed, global. Yeah. So let's take from 1960 as a point of reference. So we've now got, so the last 64 years, we've been progressively, you know, the, if we talk about fast fashion, not a phrase I'm massively keen on, but the fashion has essentially got faster and faster, right, for 64 years. And so we've had this kind of, you know, 49 and a half odd thousand years where we're mega sustainable, 300 years where we're kind of doing okay because it's all out of fibers at least, and then this past 64 years where we are royally fucking stuff up. So I'm kind of mega interested in how do you either return to where we were, and I think there's going to be a hot, one of the reasons I push such novel fabrics is I think there's going to be biosynthetics that are going to replace a lot of this stuff. I mean, I think the idea that we are making out of cotton and plastic in 100 years is absolutely gone. I think we'll be synthesizing proteins that make clothes. We'll be doing, you're going to be able to grow the shit essentially. So I kind of look back and I go, how do we effectively, you know, use labs to synthesize the things we had? And I look forward, which is, well, how do you make a piece of clothing last a really, really long time? How do you get away from this idea of like, oh, hey, I bought a hoodie and next year I'm going to buy a hoodie and next year I'm going to buy a hoodie. And so my way of communicating that really early on was kind of through, well, can you make a really, really tough hoodie that's resistant to lots of things? We make one called the 100-year hoodie that's resistant to kind of fire and 19,400 degree electrical explosions and water and wind and all sorts of things that you kind of probably, you know, you're going to die if you have too much of. Mm-hmm. But the very positioning of that is really designed as it's cool and I love it and I fucking live in the thing. But it's also a kind of thought experiment because the minute you put 100 year in someone's head, they're like, huh, what? Because that's unusual, right? That's you don't think about clothing with inherent time spans. It's something you just ignore. So if you have a pet or a child, right, there's a time span for that pet. A pet's going to last about 10 to 20 years.
Oh,
a child is going to be with you from at least 0 to 18 and then maybe longer if they really like being at home. And so these things, you know, if I cook a lasagna, that's going to last one evening. And so everything comes with a time span, but clothing is kind of one of those invisible time spans where it's like, well, you know, I buy it, I really fucking love it. It has a key place in my wardrobe for maybe a year, then it moves to the back of the wardrobe, then it maybe moves to the floor, then maybe it gets kind of like disappeared somewhere. And it's just very, very invisible. And we don't think about those longer term things. So the way we think about it is, first of all, in trying to work with effectively, I can go into it more, but effectively lab synthesized materials that go back to recreating what we had, you know, 5,000 years ago. And I work with novel materials that can outlive you, essentially, that you can hand down to your kids. So those are the two ways I approach it. Oh, and then there's probably a third way, which is you know, synthesizing nature, creating stuff that outlives you. And then the other way is basically working with shit that's already there. So garbage. So sort of, you know, we've made, you know, sweaters before out of mashed up bulletproof vests.
Mm-hmm.
Where you go, well, that's going to live on landfill for 1,000 years. So let's at least, you know, but because the bulletproof vest, sorry, not the jumper. So at least let's make something else out of it and see if we can kind of at least endlessly recycle the materials we always have. So,
okay, that's just to interrupt. I think that's a very, very important distinction that you're making. Because I think if you're, say, just to put myself in a listener shoes for a moment, and they, you know, people are like, why the hell is this brand making stuff that's actually going to last a really, really long time? One of the things that I heard you say was that you're also taking things that were already going to go into those landfills. The example, the vests, and then you're making stuff from that and kind of re-engineering versus let's re-engineer a bunch of stuff out of nothing that essentially is just going to be even worse than, say, a regular biodegradable garment. And, you know, again, there's asterisks all over this conversation, but yes, because I think that's important to communicate.
Wait a second. I got to get my bids in on the Bezel app, but more on that in a minute. I get all sorts of emails and questions from you all, which I love to read and respond. And one thing I constantly get, and even read in the Blammo Slack, is what watch should I buy and where should I get it? It's a wild world out there with all sorts of websites and shops, but I go to Bezel. Bezel is the trusted marketplace for buying and selling your next luxury watch with expert in-house authentication on every purchase. First off, folks, it's getbezel.com. That's getbezel.com. But I use and recommend Bezel because it's the best of both worlds. You can go to the site and browse a marketplace of luxury watches, over 16,000 of them, by the way, which is a lot. And I know that Bezel is going to authenticate your purchase. Or you can create an account and get connected with your own private client advisor called the concierge. Because look, making a watch purchase can be confusing, especially when you don't know all the reference numbers. When was this made? Did they use ceramic then? Is it a triple lop, dingle top? You know, what the heck? I don't even know. But they do at Bezel, and they're here to help. Concierge, baby! Look, if looking for your watch to mark a special occasion, or maybe you're just doing research, right? They even have their own journal where you can learn all the ins and outs about Bezel and the brands and all the stuff that's happening right now. But back to my bids. Yes, Bezel now has auctions, and not just any auctions. They got Rolex, they got Cartier, they got Audemars Piguet, all the big dogs and more. So you can discover, bid, and know the Bezel team has got your back with verified in-house authentication. So visit getbezel.com on your smartphone or computer. Bezel, the trusted marketplace for buying or selling your next luxury watch.
Yeah, so I agree. So you can think about that as basically, there's two sort of themes going on in there. The first one is in situ utilization, which is a posh way of saying use what you have. Mm-hmm. So when Matt Damon in The Martian, you know, grows his potatoes in his poo, you know, that's in situ utilization. What have you got and what can you do with it?
Yeah.
And you go, well, we've already got an absolute ton of this stuff. So every bulletproof vest, I think it has like a year's lifespan. Firefighter suits might have a 2-year lifespan.
Really?
And then they're just tiny, because the minute you sort of do anything with it, it has to be sort of thrown away. Chemical suits are the same thing. They have to be destroyed. Oh. So you've got these things that already exist there. And then, yes, so in situ utilization basically means don't create a whole bunch of new materials. Look at the stuff we already have and see what we can do with it. And so this ties in with the idea that, you know, very, very few people are willing to talk about, which is this idea of resource scarcity. So, right. So the earth is finite, right? There's only so much shit you can dig out of the ground mm-hmm. before you run out of shit.
Yeah.
That's why everyone's really keen on mining asteroids, because there's loads more stuff. And don't worry, your mobile phone's going to be safe because we'll mine the Kuiper Belt and, you know, we'll still be able to get all the, you know, rare elements that we need. And so if you think of Earth as finite, then it is absolutely ludicrous to be making new materials. It's insane. It's completely insane, because anything else is just pretending that the Earth isn't finite. But it is. It self-regenerates in some instances, but you can't, you know, self-regenerate the last 50 million years to, you know, create all the things that are in the Earth over time. So yeah, we think a lot about resource scarcity. So what is there already that we can go and fuck around with? You know, bulletproof vests are particularly funny, because, you know, a jumper made out of bulletproof vests is just amusing, you know.
Absolutely. But I'm sure it's, you also let people know that it is not bulletproof anymore.
We have a small asterisk somewhere that says, don't shoot your friend if they're wearing this. Yeah.
Please, thou shalt not hurt.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, that one's fireproof, because like it's made with all sorts of insane stuff. So
yeah,
you've got to think. Have you ever seen the film Wall-E by
Oh,
Pixar?
Absolutely. But, okay, the entire time we've been talking, I'm like, Wall-E. He's talking about Wall-E. I'm like, talking about Wall-E.
Yeah. And you go, at some point, if we don't sort of get our act together as a species, which feels quite unlikely, we're going to be, you know, our resources are basically going to be garbage dumps.
Yeah.
I think we're going to be sort of rooting through them. And you can see that in parts of the world already. So pretending it doesn't happen is just a lie, because there, you know, you could send out, you know, 10 documentary photographers now to go and make a Netflix series each about, you know, here are the garbage dumps where people live.
Yeah.
And so pretending that doesn't happen is just kind of really stupid. And so I think what fashion, which I don't necessarily feel particularly connected to, tries to do a lot of the time is distance itself from realities. And so it would like to pretend that stuff doesn't exist, but it does exist. It doesn't mean that fashion's, you know, totally culpable for it, because lots of these things, you'll find lots of, you know, computers.
Sure.
You know, I was going to say rotting away, but they're not rotting, are they? They're just sitting there. but it feels much more interesting, relevant, the right idea to go and look at that pile of shit and go, what's in that we could make stuff out of? Because then you're not having to generate new stuff. And at the same time, that, you know, I'm equally interested in going into the lab. Because, you know, one of the really, really untalked about stuff is how we color clothing. You know, it's all pretty.
Oh, like dyes.
It's petroleum based. So we're working with DNA and with black algae and with crushed up almonds and with minerals and all of these things, just to see, okay, well, how can we do this? And again, because we don't have any vested interest, right? We're not like some, you know, multi-billion-dollar company. It's like, oh shit, we can't say that because the people in Division X are going to be really cross. And then,
yeah, which I think is an advantage, correct?
Yeah, it is. Because then you can go, well, I'm happy to talk about it. You know, you have lots of, I'm not going to run anyone down here, but there's, you know, lots of big clothing brands that are built around a certain type of material that some people like and some people don't. And they have absolutely no incentive whatsoever to come out and find the alternative for that.
Well, and I think that's the kind of elephant in the room, is the sense that how do we communicate, we, you, whom, whatever, communicate the importance of this to a overtly consumeristic culture that looks at clothing as disposable, but also doesn't really have the true desire to have the depth of a relationship with clothing. Because like right now, I mean, you're telling me this, I am 100% sold. Like, I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. And also, I mean, I've seen your stuff before. Like, it helps that it's not, it kind of blends in with the existing landscape of clothing, right? I'm not wearing a star suit with the thing where someone sees me wearing it, they're like, what the hell? I'm like, oh, this is future clothes. You know, it blends in with how we are all already dressing. And I think like, that's the thing where it's like, so how do, you know, you as a brand, because it sounds like your challenge, you know, and I'm not projecting here, is more or less trying to change the mindset of consumerism and how people have these relationship with your clothes. Because, you know, it sounds like it's relatively easier to get these clothes made and to have this mindset on your own, but to then communicate that to your potential customer, you know, I feel like it's probably the harder part.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting set of questions and challenges. Like, so there's a thing in advertising we always talk about, which is like an education campaign is like the most expensive campaign you'll ever do.
Yeah.
Because people don't necessarily want to be educated, right? You know, they have hard jobs and hard lives. And they just, you know, they want to be able to feed their kids. They probably want to be able to go out for dinner. They don't really want a brand lecturing them on shit they shouldn't think. Because like everyone has a kind of bullshit filter to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because because like ultimately this brand is me and my brother. Like that's, we run it and we always have done. But the brand isn't a person. No brand is a person, but brands pretend to be people, right? They pretend to have, you know, we've got a set of views and this is what we think about X, and we're going to project this into the world and we're going to project our good morals and all of this stuff. But brands aren't people. They're just not. It's a completely separate entity. So I'm not personally massively in favor of doing education campaigns, because they tend to be either really boring or really expensive. And neither of which is particularly good. And so what we've set out to do is really just make stuff that people want to talk about. Because if you make the piece of clothing the social currency, then your customers are doing the education piece, right? So you always got to think about it. Like the thing that was always held up in advertising is basically, it's a really old school way of thinking about it. But essentially, you know, if you go to a pub or a bar, can you tell your friend the ad you saw? It's really simple. I saw this thing where X happened and it was really funny, right? And so that's kind of social currency where someone is basically sharing the shit you've done.
Word of mouth, right? Yeah.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. And we always thought that our clothing should essentially be the same. So the way in typically is through the name. And so like if we make something called an apocalypse jacket, well, fuck me, that better be strong. And, you know, I really want it to be zombie proof.
Yeah.
And then you go, okay, well, I have to then go and find a material for that. And so we worked. This is coming to answer your question. It's a slightly roundabout way. So the apocalypse jacket we made with something called PBI, which was invented by Dr. Marvel, genuinely, during the Cold War for NASA, when they asked him to invent a fiber with no melting point. So off he scuttles and he invents PBI, which has a melting point of, you know, I think it's just under 3,000 degrees. I think it's 2,900. Wow. And it could resist re-entry into a Earth's atmosphere. They made the Apollo missions pajamas out of it. They ended up coating the spaceship in it. So it's like really, really hardcore. So we're then like, but it hadn't been used in commercial clothing. So we're like, okay, cool. That's what our apocalypse stuff is made out of. And then we lined it with pockets, like literally inside and out, like 27 pockets, this integrated system. So you could pack all sorts of stuff in it. Now, I feel I've done the hard work there. But if I walk into the bar and I say, ladies and gentlemen, I've invented the apocalypse jacket, let me tell you why this is much better than commercial clothing and fast fashion, even though it's more expensive. Guy walks into a bar with apocalypse jacket. Mate goes, what's that? Oh, it's the apocalypse jacket. The what? Apocalypse jacket does this. And so they do it for you. Now, even if let's say we had, you know, a marketing budget, a mythical marketing budget of $1 billion,
mm-hmm.
you're probably still going to let people do it for themselves, because everyone's going to tell that story in a different way. And that is kind of like, it's effectively like a backdoor into sustainability, because it goes, well, that jacket's supposed to live with me until the end of the world, which I might not see, hopefully, you know.
Yeah.
That allows them to talk about the story in a way they're comfortable with. What I'm never comfortable with is brands where they go, you know, we've invented, you know, fiber X or material Y, and it's the solution to all clothing problems and sustainability. You go, come off it. Of course it's not. It's never going to be. This isn't going to be solved by one thing. It's going to be solved by a gradual mindset shift. And so the way we think about it is basically creating products that have abilities that normal clothes don't have, that people then tell each other about. So a guy is wearing a black hoodie, but his happens to be fireproof, waterproof, and windproof. The guy next to him is wearing a black hoodie. He's going to be throwing his hoodie away in a year. Our guy is going to be handing his hoodie down to his kids.
Well, and that's essentially what fashion is, in a sense, when we're all wearing jeans or whatever. And someone says, well, what makes your jeans better than mine? When most people are like, well, the core, you know, purpose of this jean is to just clothe you, right? Well, you know, even apart from, you know, protecting against the elements, whatever it is, it's in nowadays, you know, if you're in some sort of first, second, whatever world, it's just clothing you. And so in this way, the difference is, well, my jean is selvage, you know, or my jean is this. Yeah. And so in your case, you're like, well, this lasts 100 years or 1,000 years or is fireproof. And I think that's really great, to be honest with you, especially considering the fact that you seem far more grounded in this than someone who might have a similar mission. Let's use an example of like entrepreneurial LinkedIn guy, right? Let's call him the LinkedIn guy. And everything he's saying is just like earth changing, shattering, you know, and so much that people are now, they have like a bullshit, you know, alert every time they're around this person, because this person appears to live in a reality that doesn't exist yet. And it sounds like you are trying to, you know, you're kind of walking in two worlds, in which you're making these garments, which are incredible, but you're also being like, look, here are the real challenges of every day. And you're right. Like you know, I can't do a advertising campaign, or it's not even like my desire is to sell this to a government, right? I mean, that still, when you look at how a lot of clothing came to be, a lot of it came from government, you know, designs, Gore-Tex, mil-spec, Ripstop, etc. So, I mean, I think like I'm more fascinated as like, what is it in your head that makes you grounded with these things?
I just try to look at reality, right? So one of the interesting things I find is I grew up in the middle of England, which was an incredibly boring place.
Where?
A place just outside Birmingham. I'm not sure what the American equivalent is, but
St. Louis.
Okay, just think of somewhere quite boring. No nature, not really anything to do. And it rained all the time, apart from 2 weeks a year in July, where it might creep up to about 20 degrees, so like 68, something like that. And it rained all the time, but there were never any floods. I never saw a flood, right? The floods you saw were like, I don't know, you might see it on the news in India, like once every 3 years or something. And now you turn on the news, there's just floods all the time.
In your hometown?
In England, but also in lots in America.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Australia.
And, yes.
And every other country. And so I look at that and I go, huh, that didn't used to happen. And so you just simply have to acknowledge that is happening. And so then I look at it and I obviously run a clothing company. So I go, well, how are we going to actually tackle that? And then you look at the world of waterproofness and you go, well, you know, it's all measured in this absolutely bonkers way where effectively a small square few centimeters of fabric is put on a table.
Yeah.
And then a really tall vial of water is balanced carefully on top of it to see at what point the water goes through. And you're like, yeah, well, I've spent a bit of time at the sea and I spent a bit of time in and around water, and that isn't how water works. That's not how it hits you. It doesn't weight neatly on a specific bit of the fabric in a column. And so you're like, well, the very essence of how waterproofness is created appears to be not bullshit, but riding fairly close to bullshit. So it does work, but it works in these really kind of like confined lab settings. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, we've both been out in rain. I presume we've both seen the sea. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work like a laboratory, right? So you then go, well, what do you actually need to do to design like super waterproof clothing? So we started looking at nanotechnology solutions where basically water can't even balance on the material because actually that material is made up of thousands and thousands of nanoscopic spikes, essentially. So imagine if you shrunk Mount Everest down, that the whole mountain range actually down, put it on a piece of material, water can't actually balance on that because the spikes are too sharp.
Okay.
Whereas actually traditional material is quite flat, and so the water can sit and get absorbed. So you start to look at nanotechnology, and then we start to look at all the scuba diving gear. And so we just start to pile together technologies until we invent a range called Waterfall Proof. And you know, one of the things, you know, I've had, you know, apparently amazingly waterproof jackets, but then your shoulders get wet because something's going to get wet eventually, but it's because the seam is there. And so the water finds a way of working it through. So we took out all the shoulder seams. So we will take a challenge where I go, okay, well, there seems to be quite a lot of floods everywhere. I wonder if we can make some adaptable clothes for that. And then you just work through the problems. And then that range of waterfall proof gear has got better and better as we've done more and more of it. And then we find new technologies to add into it. But I simply watch stuff. I mean, I think the problem with lots of clothing companies is because clothing is a social signifier, they don't think really hard about critical kind of infrastructure realities of life. Mm-hmm. They think about trends. And right. So they go, oh, right. Oh, like dadcore is a cool thing. Or
yeah.
look at what kids on TikTok are doing with this color red. And it's just like, and that will then, you know, that will make its way into a concept team or a design team. And before you know it, they've spat out a whole season based around some kind of, you know, maybe good idea, maybe bad idea, but it's incredibly trend based and it's really focus group based. And it just doesn't accept the cold, hard realities of life. So because the other thing I'm exploring is obviously clothes for space.
Right.
And so I'm just fascinated at a point where, like, step back for a second. Like, humans have wanted to go and visit the stars. I mean, at least 50,000 years ago, and we have carvings at least 20,000 years old to show sort of fascination with that, and probably much, much older. But we can. So we're going to. So, like, but before you and I die, there's going to be people living on other fucking planets.
You're like, you really think so? I want to believe this because, like, you know, I have a joke that, like, but it's more true. Before I die, I would like to go to space. And, you know, friends of mine are like, dude, Kirkland, you're an idiot. That's so dumb. By the way, why would you ever want to go there anyway? There's literally no oxygen there. Like, it's, you know, because I'm terrified of going deep underwater. I was on a weird like press trip and they gave us these cool like underwater like jet skis, you know, it's called a ski bob or sea bob. Really great. Yeah. But I mine went out of control and it yanked me deep underwater and it scared the shit out of me. Like I thought I was going to die. And so I'm kind of terrified of that. And my friend's like, so you can't even handle the ocean. Like you want to go to space? Like what the fuck are you doing? But I really do. I mean, that's a plan. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how I'm going to get the money. I don't know. But like in my head, I was like, all right, could I do it, you know, 40, 50 years from now? I feel like maybe. I don't know. But yeah. I think we'll be there. I mean, because did you see that? I think it came out maybe last week where some company wants to mine helium from the moon.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I'd probably leave the moon alone.
Yeah, it's going to mess with all of our water.
Yeah, yeah. It has some quite important functions in terms of the state.
Yeah.
I'm just practical. I look where the money's going. So what are all the richest guys on Earth doing? They're all trying to get us to space. How much, you know, compare it to the era of the, you know, Gettys, Carnegies, Mellons, you know, what were they doing? Well, the practical realities of life follow the finances, right? And so you look at the money trail's going to space. It has to go to space, not just in terms of tourism, but for resources, because, you know, all of our technology is going to depend on effectively rare earth minerals. And so we're going to run out of them, but there's, you know, go and look at the Oort cloud or Kuiper belt or there's shit tons of them. I mean, you've got, you know, asteroids that are going to be like $1 trillion. And so someone's going to find a way to go get that. And then off the back of it, you're going to get tourism. So yeah, I even if it's not in our lifetime, so even say we're 100 years out, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very unique point to live at. So we, you know, ever since, you know, the invention, you know, Oppenheimer's bomb, right? We can literally destroy our Earth. We can't actually blow the planet up. We can destroy our ability to live on it. And we'll probably be able to go and live somewhere else. that's just an amazing time to be alive, like really fucking extraordinary. And then, you know, however we think it's being originated, there is clearly like very serious climactic change happening in terms of heat and water. And so as a designers design for problems, right?
Right.
And so you go, well, that's my problem set. My problem set is there's still an ability for some crazy fucker somewhere to stick their finger on a red button and blow at least a bit of the world up.
Yeah.
Cool. I'll design apocalypse gear. There are floods everywhere. Cool. I'll design waterfall proof gear. There are wildfires happening all over the planet. Cool. I'll design fireproof 100-year gear. We appear to be going up to space quicker than we imagined. Great. I've designed Mars hoodies that help you kind of relax. And so I just look at like the world as it is as a problem set, and then I design against that. So it's much more like an architect, for instance, where they're given a brief and it's like, well, we've got building A, it's in city B.
Your briefs are just chaos.
Yeah. And we need it to achieve C. And so, yeah, my brief is chaos. Yeah. And so, but you know, as you said earlier, it doesn't mean I need to make it look like, you know, David Bowie.
Yeah.
it can look like normal clothing. Cause I think, you know, the kind of, the false impression people have is that, you know, technology is, you know, necessarily going to look crazy because it does crazy things. But you know, look at the iPhone. I mean, it's like, it's a black little object. Like if you gave that to a farmer 100 years ago, it's a weird stone, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what the fuck is it? And then you go, oh, well, that's your bank and your map and your way of talking to your mom. And it has all the information in the world, and you can take photographs of your children on it. And it's a musical instrument. And it's also a video camera. You don't know what videos are yet. And you can watch TV. You don't have a TV yet. So, but it's just in this really, not slating Apple. So I love Apple and I love Apple phones. But it's an effectively a very, very anodyne, boring object. If you compare it to the history of design where we have, you know, pyramids and sphinxes.
Agreed.
And the Parthenon, yeah. it's a black rectangle. Let's be fair. And I think that's where clothing will go, which is when we have all of these mad abilities, I don't think it's going to look like something out of Superman.
Yeah.
I think it's just going to be absorbed. It's going to be black. It's going to be kind of invisible. And it's just kind of going to be there. Like the way the internet's there, right? You don't need to understand how the internet works to know you have it on your phone. You don't see all the whiz bang shit. It doesn't come attached with the server farm. You know, you just got a black object in your hand and it kind of works.
Yeah.
And I think that's where clothing will go. So I think the mistake people make when they think about like, oh, the future is it goes all Star Trek-y. And I don't think it will. It's not going to be shiny.
So
I think it's going to be quite discreet.
If a lot of these designs are reactions to chaos, but for needs to protect oneself and continue to progress. Talk to me about your anxiety here. How do you handle this stuff? Because like for me, I mean, if this is really where my head is at, I mean, I have anxiety issues of just a person who, you know, is just worried about their kids. Like how are you able to kind of compartmentalize, you know, and figure these things out without just like retreating and hiding in a box somewhere?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I won the geographic lottery, I guess, in that I live in, you know, in England, which is, you know, pretty safe.
Yeah.
And there isn't a huge level of violence. There isn't a huge, you know, climate change has not hit the UK perhaps as hard as it's hit other countries. So I've got friends in Australia, like in Sydney, and they're like every summer they are literally surrounded by fire.
Yeah,
I've got friends in LA. Every summer they're surrounded by fire. So that's not going to happen here because our country just isn't hot enough. And then the floods, you know, typically happen up north and down south, not sort of where I am. And so on a very practical level, I'm privileged enough to be protected in where I physically live. So this doesn't really stem out of anxiety. It really stems out of a surprise that other designers have not picked up on realities and designed against it. And it's more of a, I don't even know how to describe it. It's basically, I just look at it and go, why the fuck are people not doing this? Okay, I'll do it. It's like that.
Okay.
It's like, because I just see it as so logical. I see it as so logical of, well, what's the coldest weather gear you can make? Like, how do you go about making that? So it's more a kind of like, it's probably more of a practical scientific inquiry as a response to the times we live in. And that's a reaction against other people not responding. So let's say we're in literature, right, for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is writing, like, you know, I'm going to name a writer I don't like because I find it incredibly boring. Jane Austen, right?
Really? You're not a fan of Jane Austen?
Not a huge fan.
Man, what an incredible
what a surprise, take. Eh?
Yeah, so go ahead, sorry.
So basically, it appears to be people living in quite big buildings, looking out of windows longingly, kind of sad about relationships that used to exist, right?
Yeah.
And let's say...
She's a very emotional writer. Love.
Sure. and so let's say that all literature mm-hmm. is Jane Austen, right? Okay. And then someone comes along, like Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote Fight Club, or Bret Easton Ellis, you know, American Psycho, and it's like acid has been poured on the page, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say they come along. That's how I feel. I look at it. It goes, why is everyone doing Jane Austen? I feel like Chuck Palahniuk and Bret Easton Ellis, where I go, cool, I'll go do all of this. Does no one else want to write like this?
Oh.
That's how I feel. So like, because I don't really see anyone massively stepping out to design like this. And so I look at it as like a really saturated market, saturated by one type of thinking. And that type of thinking is super short-termist. And it's very, very focused around, what are people going to want next? And you're like, okay, yeah, but that's for 1 year. But what are they going to want in 10 years or 20 years?
Well, like, what are your thoughts on brands like Acronym? Because I feel like, you know, Errolson Hugh, who's done Acronym, like that's, you know, that's been a mindset, not so much of designing against chaos, but more or less, you know, trying to utilize technology. And there's a very strong influence of defense in his stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, but I mean, you know, are there other brands or anyone that you sort of like or admire or see yourself against? Or do you really feel you're alone on an island?
No, I don't want to pretend I'm alone on an island, because obviously that's just quite arrogant. So yes, obviously, like, I don't know the guys at Acronym, but obviously know of it. And
yeah.
So I'm familiar with the people operating in the space. Where I'm trying to go, without giving away sort of state secrets, is we're going quite a lot deeper tech with a lot of our stuff that will start to emerge over the next 2 to 3 years.
Because most of Acronym stuff, for clarity's sake for listeners, is not, I would say, as far as I'm aware, and someone can at me, I don't think they have any proprietary fabrics. A lot of it is utilizing Schoeller, the Swiss company, Gore-Tex, DuPont stuff, things that already exist versus, you know, the stuff that you and I are talking about. These are fabrics that have not really been engineered, more or less, for day-to-day wear.
But, you know, very cool designer. I think
I
watched him do the, was it the bottle top challenge, where he kicked the bottle top off with a kind of like super kung fu-y move. He's a cool dude, right?
Yeah, I mean,
I would love to hang out with him. He seems super, super fucking cool. So, no, we're not on an island as we stand now.
Okay.
But because I know where we're headed and who we're working with, it will be an island, I think, because effectively I'm fascinated between that merger of clothing and technology, where you'll start to not be able to distinguish between what the tech function is and what the clothing is. And that's a really hard thing to do. Essentially, technology is hard and clothing is soft. So on a physical thing, so like, you know, everything you own that is tech is hard. You knock it on a table and it goes bang. And clothing doesn't. It's a soft piece of material.
Yeah.
Those two things are going to merge, and they're going to merge at a nanoscopic scale, and they're going to start to have functionality we didn't anticipate. And I'm not talking about kind of it measures your heart rate, because for sure, I mean, everyone's going to be able to do that. I'm talking about much deeper stuff where it's going to start interacting with you.
The things that I'm the most impressed by now that I think is completely overlooked are the fact that, so a friend of mine has diabetes, and he has a wearable Bluetooth insulin monitor where he can look at his phone or his Apple Watch or whatever, and he can basically see his blood sugar levels, you know, and like the fact that that's actually been around for a long time is kind of mind-blowing to me. And it makes me wonder, like, do you think the challenges for your brand are more on the consumer side of educating the consumer, which I know you don't want to do an education plan, or like the regulation side, in the sense that like to exist in these markets, you are somewhat regulated. So like, say you want to start a glasses company.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that's a fuck ton of work, because just to get a license to give people things that could someday be, you know, are viewed, whether we like it or not, in the medical side, it's bound by regulation. So I think like that is a question I'm quite curious about, is as you kind of veer more into these things, especially things that are almost bio engineered, you know, you're going to eventually come against regulation, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think clothes will become so technological. I think you will enter an era of opt-in, opt-out, essentially, of clothing, without going all sort of 1984 George Orwell on it.
Yeah.
Your clothes are going to know more about you than you know about yourself. They're going to understand your emotional state, what your brainwaves are doing before you know it, and they're going to be anticipating it, and they're going to be interacting with it. Now, I'm not saying that's going to be, you know, necessarily done instantly by me.
Agreed.
or on a time scale, yeah, where we're both still alive. But you are, every human being is a walking mass of data being spat out and sucked in that we don't even think about. Like we think we're these kind of, you know, solid, self-determined organisms. We're not even vaguely, you know, there's constantly kind of liquid gas, radiation, UV light passing through us. There's, yeah, you know, yeah, yeah. Three trillion bacteria, our inner biome, 3 trillion bacteria deciding probably how we feel and what we're going to do today. And your clothing is going to interact with that. That's what it's going to do. So I think we will rapidly head towards an opt-in, opt-out model where you will effectively, I think you'll go through the era of the Luddites again, where there's going to be people who 100% kind of reject any embedded technology. But you can see it sort of softly playing already, right? Anyone who has a heart transplant or kind of, you know, a little like chip in their heart to keep waking it up or make it beat regularly, or, you know, a hearing aid that's implanted. So we will move. It'll be slowly at first and then very rapidly we're going to move into a state of enhanced organisms effectively. And your clothing will be a very, very key part of that ecosystem. And so, yeah, it will become heavily regulated. And so clothing isn't, which is obviously hilarious at the moment. Anyone could, you know, buy a Shopify website, you know, contact that factory in China, spit out a million black t-shirts, you know, miracle a campaign from somewhere that sells those black t-shirts, and no government is going to come after them. No one's going to give a shit. It's just black t-shirts you're selling.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it will become a regulated industry. It's very difficult to predict the timescale, but the timescale is going to be completely attached to the amount of technology that's embedded and the knowledge that technology has about you. But yeah, it's going to know a phenomenal amount.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's going to change.
I think we're already seeing it in ways of companies that are doing how things fit, right? Because essentially they're building a database of people and how certain garments fit on those people. And if you look at that, like that data can be used for a variety of things in which you're more or less sussing the size, and you could, you know, start to calculate the BMI of these like different populations in different cities and different sort of things, where you can be like, okay, well, St. Louis is more obese than Nashville, or London has got these things, because they can measure all these ways in which we're looking at how we're inputting our sizes. I mean, the fact that, you know, people are already using data for clothing stuff just on a commerce level, where they're like, hey, we're going to build a store in A, B, C, and D, because we have these commerce shops and we see that all these people who spend this much sort of, you know, and I think some of that stuff is kind of nice. But yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting. Like for me, like the biggest sort of fear, concern is where things like, I don't know, did you try the Vision Pro?
Not yet.
Okay. That thing is, I got to try it out. It's cool for, you know, a few minutes, but it also scared the absolute shit out of me, because all of a sudden I realized something was monitoring my eyes and everything I was looking at, which scared the hell out of me, even though Apple's got some privacy thing, whatever, right? I don't buy any of that stuff. And then the fact that there's cameras externally that are viewing what my hands are doing at all times. And it's funny, like one reviewer, I think it was like Neil Patel or whatever from The Verge, he was like, I think people should be very concerned about any sort of, you know, computing device that has access to the internet that can not only see what you're seeing, but also see what you're doing with your hands while you're doing it. You know, and that's not even like a sexual joke, but there's like, you can find it in there, right?
Yeah.
But I think like that's a thing where you start to get into privacy stuff. And I think that's, you know, when you mentioned the Luddite stuff, like you're already kind of seeing it with some of the like Gen Z people that are like anti phones and anti Instagram and anti, you know, which in some ways is refreshing, but like, are, you know, how will that mindset shift down the road? You know, are their kids going to be more into technology, you know, or I don't know.
Well, the way I look at it is I sort of look at sort of like what I call longer term consensus realities, right? So our consensus reality today is that, you know, broadly, science is right. We live in a materialist universe.
Yeah.
It is good to earn money. Children shouldn't be slaves. They should go to school. We have all of these kind of things that we all generally agree on. Mm-hmm. But if we cut back 1,000 years, you won't find a single civilization that agrees on many of those things at all. And so the way I tend to look at these things is I tend not to look at the immediate future is obviously a very logical extension of the present. Mm-hmm. But the long-term future is probably not. The long-term future is probably predicated around giant shifts in what consensus reality is, right? So we've lived in this kind of post-Enlightenment paradigm for the last couple of 100 years where science wins and it knows everything. And it's like, well, it can only explain sort of like 5% of the known universe. So it probably doesn't know everything yet. And yeah. I think we could see a massive swing back. I think the emergence, so I look at sort of like what I call really nascent consensus realities, which is things that not very many people think, but the people who do think them are really fucking clever.
Okay.
And then I look at how those could have a wider impact. And so, for instance, like one of those earliest thoughts is, you know, the idea that potentially we don't live in a universe of energy, we live in a universe of consciousness.
Whoa.
And so off the basis of that, you know, those Apple glasses, fuck me. I mean, they might connect you to God. I mean, who knows, right? So sure. I think there's some really strange things coming down the line. So I try to design for things where you go, there's a really clear time horizon on them. There's like a, you know, it's either immediate or there's like, you can see where that's going over the next 50 years. I think predicting where cut forward 1,000 years, right? Or even, you know, a couple of hundred. We're going to be living on multiple planets. We will have, you know, bionic extensions on our bodies, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because mm-hmm. Like there's people like Hugh Herr at MIT already building these things. And it's like, it's not going to take too long before someone decides to build a wing rather than an arm, right? And then you build two wings and suddenly, well, I'm flying. So you're going to have these, you know, potentially we're going to be creatures that live not just on Earth, but on other planets and we can fly. It's like, well, fucking hell, I want to make a jacket for that, right?
Yeah.
Because like someone's going to have to make a coat for that. And so, I think there's, I was watching Isaac Asimov predict the future this morning. I think it was from maybe 1960s, 70s.
Okay.
Fuck me, he was good. It was so good. Just like with complete and utter clarity. So some guy was asking him, you know, will computers really be important? He's just like, yeah. They're going to be the center of our universe. They're going to be the center of the home. They're going to be dictating everything to do with entertainment and education. And so, but I see predicting beyond that kind of like time horizon from 50 years is like super dangerous if you look at the massive shifts you see in civilizations and cultures, and ultimately those changes are what drives changes across everything else. So technology is developed around those things and clothing follows the technology. And so but ultimately, yeah, I mean, the stuff I want to be designing like 200 years out, you know, for the people who literally fly on Mars. If so, we will, that's where we're going.
Well, I'm all for that. But then how do you stay alive for that time? Because that's the elephant in the room is how do you, you know, create something that, you know, I mean, obviously we're human. We can't live forever.
Have you been following Brian Johnson?
Is that Mr. Guy who's like 20 years old, but he's 80 or some sort of shit?
Well, I think I'm not actually sure how old he is. I think he's maybe late 40s, but he's trying to maybe become 18, something like that.
Yeah. So what are your, this is where it gets into like Jurassic Park shit. Like, you know, where it's like, you're so focused on not whether or not you can, you stop to think whether or not you should, like, right.
Yeah.
So like, is that good?
Well, my gut is you like any of these things, right? So you're going to have a few early pioneers.
Yeah.
Like look at parachutes, right? I mean, you know, eventually they got there, but you know, some people jumped off the Eiffel Tower. And like, you know, fell straight to Earth before it worked.
Yeah, it's true.
So I think in any of these, like, it's pretty interesting, right? Because you're going to have these people who've, you know, made a couple of billion or a couple of hundred million or whatever it is. And they suddenly go, oh, it's really annoying. I'm going to die. I wonder if I can stop that.
Yeah.
which is kind of really fascinating. But I mean, if they're prepared to guinea pig themselves, then, you know, fine. I mean, ultimately, I mean, I think there's a lot of money going into life extension.
Yeah,
you're going to get a lot of super rich people who find it really annoying that they're 60 years old, they're worth however many billion, and you know, probability is they've got another 10, 20 years. They're going to find that frustrating. But it's like space. And so if enough money is being chucked at it, then they're going to come up with something. Because even if the human being doesn't, so let's say you have a vain human being who would love to stay alive and be 18 years old. Well, is he clever enough on his own? No, probably not. But is he clever enough with the help of 10 tech companies all using AI? Maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
I mean, that's true.
Maybe there's enough stuff you can do.
There are people using, you know, a lot of HGH stuff, which is becoming more and more common. There's even a down in this kind of like affluent area down from me. There's this new medical center that opened up and they basically sell, you know, testosterone.
Yeah.
More or less for old dudes who want to get an extra pump in, you know, I mean, these are guys that like just want to live longer. And it's like, yeah, like you can't gain 20 pounds of muscle, you know, when you're in your 50s, but somehow these guys are doing it. So, yeah.
I think this is the example, isn't it, though, that we're going to get into this world of it starts slowly. You know, I take a little bit of testosterone. I maybe try and edit a couple of my genes that I don't particularly like.
Okay.
And then before you know it, I mean, you're wearing a fucking exoskeleton. I don't see it's going to happen really slowly, then really quickly.
Yeah.
I think it's very, probably very, very similar to how AIs work now, where, you know, a lot of the people on the forefront have been warning about this for ages, right?
Yeah.
And I remember looking at this 10 years ago and going, wow, I mean, the battle is going to be with reality. So I used to read a lot of sort of French philosophers who were kind of, don't know how to describe them, but they were very esoteric.
Okay.
But they talked a lot about how the fight was going to be between reality and unreality. And that is where we're headed of like, well, you know, how was this headline generated? Is that picture real? Did this person really say this thing? So
yeah.
I think that could have like, I mean, obviously everyone's warning about the perils of it now, but at the same time that physics is contemplating that we might not understand what reality is, we appear to have invented a system that is capable of creating realities that absolutely aren't real as we understand it. So I think we could face some really fundamental challenges, but most people, it doesn't enter what's called kitchen table politics, which is, have I got enough food to eat at the kitchen tonight?
Yeah.
And until it hits that, I don't know if people really give a shit. But my job is to look beyond that. My job is to look at kind of, or sorry, I consider my job to be to look beyond, you know, that immediate, you know, tomorrow. It's to look at like 10 years out and 20 years out and 50 years out and start making predictions and start going, okay, we're looking in this area. That's gone very, very highfalutin. I apologize.
No, I think this is a phenomenal discussion. I'm very, very intrigued by all of it.
You can probably tell there isn't like a PR person sitting next to me. No, going, hey,
which is good.
Say this.
Because I'll be honest with you, like when we were talking about, to zoom way back, you know, when we first started, like what we ended up talking about is something that is important to you and you're passionate about, right?
Yeah.
And that is going to convey 1,000% more than any, well, wait, hold on, I didn't tell you about this, or why this is special, or we have a deal right now on blank and blank. Like, people are very intelligent, and they will, yeah, once they connect with a person, they're going to start to do more research, and they're going to eventually find all the aspects and the other things that you care, yeah, about, which is why whenever I tell people, you know, I've had people on the show, and sometimes there is a PR person back there, and they're like, well, wait, you need to mention this. I'm like, you are going to ruin this. Like, I get what you're trying to, yeah, do, but if a listener can't connect with the other person, then like, you know, then just go buy an advertisement on Instagram. There's no point of this, you know? And so, yeah, anyway, I mean, I digress, but like, I'm curious with all these things, you know, is there anything that like you kind of do to just chill out and unwind? Like, you know, what are the other things? Cause it sounds like so much of your life is very focused. So what are the things that you maybe introduce into your life that kind of, you know, touch grass per se?
Yeah. Well, I spend a huge amount of my time, certainly in my head, living in the future.
Yeah.
It's just a thing. I've always had it. I think it's probably a reaction because my mom kind of lives in the past. And okay, so it's probably this is the brand is probably some kind of, rebellion.
Yeah.
But I do a lot of things that would be considered very odd, and I do a lot of things that would be considered very normal. So I love sport. Like, so one of the things I do in order to think about all these crazy ideas is I run, and I have in the past run very long distances across, you know, my brother ran across the Amazon, and
what?
over the Alps, and we raced across the Namib Desert. So we used to race ultramarathons, and then we found out, oh, running a startup is kind of like, well, that's basically an ultramarathon, but you're allowed to have food. So
yeah, and your knees aren't going to explode.
Yeah, So on a very practical level, I mean, I love sport. I'm absolutely addicted to it. And I found that it releases all sorts of incredible chemicals that help me think in very novel ways. Because you can basically do drugs, but without doing drugs. So you can be
dopamine, basically.
Yeah. I mean, the levels of highs I've had from running, I don't know. You'd have to sit me next to someone in a lab, right, doing ecstasy or whatever. And I reckon if you did two brain scans, I'm not sure you'd be able to tell the difference of who's on drugs and who's not. So my brother and I, like when we're racing through in the Namibian desert, we had shared hallucinations, as in we're literally tripping the same trip, but we haven't done anything apart from we're running through a desert for a very long time.
Well, you are genetically linked in the sense that it's your twin brother, correct?
We are, yeah. And like we've had like shared death experiences where he's nearly died and I felt it 5,000 miles away. So like,
get the fuck out. Hold on. Wait, explain that more.
So unfortunately, when he's doing pleasurable stuff, which you can imagine, I don't experience that. But in the two instances where he's come very close to death, one where his car went off a cliff and one where he was caught in a massive rock fall on Mont Blanc, I was the first one, I was 5,000 miles away, and the second one, I was 500 miles away, and I felt them both. I knew he was about to die, and I knew specifically it was him. I couldn't tell you what he was doing, but sure. I was like, oh shit, this is it. He's gone. And which is why I don't sort of cling on to all modern science, because there obviously is no rational explanation for that. You know, I am 8 octillion carbon atoms over in Sardinia and he's 8 octillion carbon atoms technically on the side of Mont Blanc, but somehow those atoms or whatever the fucking energy thing is there, there's some kind of exchange happening that we 100% cannot explain.
Are you religious?
No, but I'm not convinced that science has particularly good answers to that. I'm always loath to go down the route of, hey, we live in a simulation just because Matrix happened.
Agree with that. Yeah.
No, I think there's a lot of like overlay strategy, which is like Hollywood does a big thing or there's some kind of technological breakthrough and suddenly life is somehow some subset of that. So, you know, we're all in a simulation because the Matrix happened, or actually life is AI generated because, you know, it's like, oh, well, that's just a bit convenient because cut back 2000 years and, you know, we had the Egyptians with gods with dogs for heads. And it's like, well, maybe we're all dogs. And so I just don't quite buy the idea that somehow our reality relates to the latest scientific breakthrough in Silicon Valley. I think that's highly, highly unlikely.
Well, I think that helps to think that, because I think there are a lot of things where, you know, science can't explain it. And eventually people choose to live in ignorance or in an effort to try to control their environment, choose to assert it towards religion, whether they believe it or not. I think that's I would say I am somewhat religious. Like I try to have an understanding of what that is, but oftentimes it's driven from fear of things that I can't control. And I assume that if there's a spiritual aspect of it, I can kind of put it in that box. Where like when you just talked about the connection, you know, the unfortunate, you know, connection between you and your brother in that instance, in my head, I'm like, oh, that's God. That's some sort of spiritual thing, that's a God thing, because now I just explained that, right? And even though that I explained something that's relatively unknown, it is something that there is a collective agreement on, I'm assuming.
So where I sort of go with it is, you know, if we live in, let's say, a universe of consciousness as opposed to a universe of energy, and I'm somehow a transmitter and receiver of that consciousness, and sort of his near-death experience is being beamed to some, you know, satellite,
right.
some consciousness satellite, and then comes back down to me. But it's not worked the other way. I was quite ill a while back, relatively recently, and I wasn't entirely sure I was going to make it. And I've spent a lot of time in nature since then. So I spend a lot of time like barefoot. I really fucking love trees. Like I find energy from weird places. I've got a friend at NASA who's working on a similar project, which is I think it's highly unlikely that trees aren't sort of, you know, conscious in some way, or there's something we just haven't quite understood. The fact that sort of DMT is like, you know, contained within all of them, and it's kind of the consciousness molecule for humans. And then we go, oh, it's just a tree, chop it down. It's not thinking anything. Now, I don't think it's there sort of reading Proust. But I think there's probably some kind of energy system there.
You get into mushroom networks and things like that underground.
I'm into that. Yeah, okay. So I mean, sort of the idea of panspermia, that life didn't necessarily start here. So I spend a lot of time reading what you consider probably pretty and exploring what you probably consider pretty fringe stuff in relation to where science is today. But, you know, I'm aware of the macro shifts that happen. And so we don't all have to necessarily bow down to sort of, I'm sure Einstein's about 6 million times cleverer than I'll ever be. But just because we live in a post-Einstein world, it doesn't mean he's completely correct about everything. And I still think there's so many things we can't explain. I spend a lot of time exploring the things that we might not necessarily understand. And then inevitably, it feeds back into how I design clothes, as ridiculous as that sounds.
Yeah,
because you then think, well, this has to interrelate at some point.
Well, so then I guess like the final question would be is like, why clothes? What's the point? Because all these things sound like, you know, what you're thinking about, what your mind is, you know, unless you're like, well, clothing is just step one, you know, which is a fair answer. But like clothing seems somewhat, you know, irrelevant compared to everything else that you're thinking about. No, is that, I'm not being rude, but yeah.
No, because I think it is step one.
Okay.
I think we're, you know, this, as I said, so maybe I said at the start, we're sort of, if you think about your body as an ecosystem, the technology is eventually going to be absorbed inside it. We're going to be adapted in so many different ways that it's almost impossible to comprehend. But effectively, imagine some sort of like hyper reality where the internet is living inside you and constantly getting smarter, right? So, but there has to be some kind of step between where we are now with, you know, as clever as all the people at Apple are, we are monkeys with big blocks of plastic hitting them with our fingers, right? On metal, right? And we just go tap, 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 and that's our lives. And we're going to look back and it's going to be as dumb as the Stone Age, right? Hey, look at these, you know, Cro-Magnon man hitting, you know, this rock with that rock in order to make some fucking bread or whatever he's making. I mean, they look back and go, it's so dumb. What, they had these objects, they touched them with their fingers. Isn't that really dirty? You're going to have all of these thoughts that are going to be really fucking crazy. And I think that clothing is basically the next medium, basically, where technology gets absorbed. And whilst I'm not utterly sold on all science that I read and hear, I am convinced that it's going to profoundly change what it means to be human. And I think that is going to be brought closer and closer to the body until it is literally absorbed by the body. And I think we're the interface before it gets absorbed.
Holy shit. This is incredible.
But I don't necessarily, like, if we're selling like a graphene t-shirt, which is cool and it's brilliant, and it's like, you know, the lightest t-shirt, I think, and it kind of like gets rid of your heat. I don't go into this because it's like, you're just like, oh, what the fuck is this?
I just wanted
a t-shirt. Thank
you. That's probably smart, I would say, because I mean, you know, thankfully we've had a lot of time to discuss this and sort of unpack and get to point, you know, A, B, Z, et cetera, versus just kind of hitting people right out the gate with that. But I think this is, I am, you know, incredibly fascinated by this entire conversation, and I'm really, really grateful we got to have it. This has been amazing.
I've enjoyed it as well. It's not I don't get to spend my days doing this. I have to do it on a bit more like prosaic stuff.
Sure. Well, I was going to say, I mean, but you know, we're starting to wrap up. Before we do, is there any other thing you want to add or mention that we didn't, you know, discuss? Just for, you know, if you were like, damn it, the point was I was supposed to mention blank and we didn't.
No, I think it then becomes a sell. I think I've definitely, like, this is the stuff we're interested in. I'm really interested in what the future looks like. How do we get there? And the current interface we're using is kind of novel material technology. But I think that the bigger point is, it's not live yet and it's not known about, but I'm exploring where that goes. And where it goes is bonkers, and people aren't kind of anticipating it. It is, you know, when Apple come out with Apple Vision Pro, like, you're right, oh yeah, I get that. Yeah, of course they're going to do that.
Yeah.
And if they came out with a car, you kind of go, yeah, I get that. Of course they're going to do that. And I don't think there's a similar expectation around clothing, which I think is wrong, because, and I think there isn't a similar expectation because no one's done it yet. But I think once somebody does do it, then people will go, oh yeah, I've always wanted that for my clothes.
Yeah. You
know? There's that classic story of like the first time internet, the Wi-Fi was on planes, and the first people, I think it's maybe flying New York to London or the other way, and people are like, oh my God, I've got internet on the plane. And then on the second flight, the internet didn't load fast enough, and people are like, for fuck's sake, why is my internet not working? And so people have this kind of like, technology is like a miracle, and then it's a frustration. all of a sudden. It's just an expectation, right?
I agree.
And yeah. I think that journey is there to be gone on clothing. And I think it needs someone who thinks about it at a deep level, which I try to do, versus a kind of, I think Sam Altman was talking about AI the other day, and he said, I think it's going to make a lot of people really rich, and then I think it's going to end the world. And he didn't frown or smile when he said Jesus. It's like, oh, that's cool. So yeah, I think this stuff is going to happen. I want to be the person who does it, because I think it needs thinking about in a really interesting way, versus just kind of like, you know what, I come back to, how can we make 1 million black t-shirts and sell them really quickly?
Yeah. Hi, sharks. Boring. My name is, yeah.
Yeah, well, I love what you do. Don't get me wrong. I love watching Shark Tank.
Yeah.
I have no Shark Tank story.
No, we got
invited on, but it's like, oh no, is it? I will get murdered.
Yeah. Smart move. Well, thank you so much for this. It was an absolute pleasure. And thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it.
It's been great fun chatting.
Thanks. All right, take care.
You've been listening to Blammo. Our show is produced by Blammo Media. We're edited by Amar Lull, and our theme music, as always, by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. If you like what you heard, you know the drill. Share the pod with a friend. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars or thumbs up on whatever other thing you're listening to us on, whether it's Dingledorp or Bing Bong, whatever it's called. But you can also follow us on Instagram for all the hot content. If you want to talk to us and give us your hot take, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at info@blammopod.com. Last but not least, super ultra important. If I had an air horn, I would press it right now. You got to come and join us over on Patreon, because the fun never stops over there. Look, the live show, the free show, whatever you want to call this, we take breaks here and there, but Patreon, it never stops. And we also got exclusive shows like Die Workwear, hosted by Derek Guy and Peter Zatolo, and the Triple J Show, hosted by yours truly with John Moy and Gene DeLeon. There's just a ton of stuff over there. So check it out at patreon.com/Blammo. If not, no worries. We got hundreds and hundreds of free episodes in the feed, and more to come. So we will see you all soon.